Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, sanitation and antibiotics have saved the lives of many, but are they also culprits behind some of our modern diseases? Then, what's troubling the waters in the South China Sea? Our next guest argues that we may have gone overboard in killing our microbes, and that may be causing some of today's epidemics. Martin Blaser is a professor of translational medicine and director of the Human Microbiome Program at New York University. His new book is called Missing Microbes: How the Overuse of Antibiotics is Fueling Our Modern Plagues. Welcome, Martin Blaser. It's great to have you here on the Scholar Circle.
I'm really happy to be here.
Your primary argument in Missing Microbes: How the Overuse of Antibiotics is Fueling Our Modern Plagues is really that a lot of our illnesses today are really resulting from killing off a lot of these microbes that help our health in many ways. I thought where we should start is what these microorganisms are themselves. You describe them almost like ecosystems.
Most of the cells in the human body are, in fact, microbial cells. That is bacteria and, to a lesser extent, fungi and protozoa. Where the bacterial cells outnumber our human cells at least 3-to-1 and maybe 10-to-1. So we're mostly bacteria. If you took all the bacteria together and put them on a scale, they'd weigh about 3 or 4 pounds, about the same weight as our brain. And what we know is that these bacteria essentially are ancient, that we got them from our mom, and she got them from her mom, and so on and so forth, all the way back in time. Not only from our mom, but that's a very important source. These bacteria do many good things for us. They help train our immune system. They help us digest food. They make vitamins for us. They help keep out invaders. So these are very useful. We could call them the good guys.
You've said in the book that really this ecology of microbes, you call it the microbiome, are really key to our immune system. What examples can you give us?
We've been doing a lot of studies in mice, and others have done studies in mice, and it's clear that the distribution of these microbes, let's say we and others in the field are doing a lot of work, we're taking a census. We're saying, okay, which microbes are present in my body and in your body, and what about my intestine versus my skin? How are they similar? How are they different? And I can tell you that if we compared my skin and your skin, our skin is closer to each other than my skin is to my mouth, for example, because each niche has its own population, as you said, its own ecosystem.
Is there some comparison we can make to the non-microbe world that can help us to understand these unique ecosystems that each of us has?
Maybe we should start by saying, what is an ecosystem? And that's a collection of species, more or less all living together. We see that in ponds and lakes, in forests, on prairies. We see all different kinds of species. On the prairies, we see different kinds of grasses and different animals and worms and fungi. They're all living together. They've been living together in general for stable ecosystems for a very long period of time. And they really pretty much define the life that is present. And they're kind of hard to budge, so that when an invader comes in, they have a hard time getting a foothold, because the local species keep them out. And, of course, we think that's true within the human body as well, that the populations of different kinds of species in our skin, on our gut, in our mouth, very complex groups of organisms, they're functioning to do their work. They're all trying to eat and have babies and baby microbes. In doing this, they have functions that are beneficial to us, and that's why we're so interested in them.
Let's talk about what is happening with the antibiotic use, because this is really the thrust of your book. You're essentially saying that most of these modern plagues, especially things like obesity, are connected directly to the abundance of antibiotics and also when they're introduced to people.
First, let's start with some facts, and that is that since World War II, a number of diseases have become much more common than they were before. That's what we could call our modern epidemics or our modern plagues. And these include such things as asthma and skin allergies, eczema, food allergies, wheat allergy, includes obesity and diabetes, even autism, inflammatory bowel disease. So imagine that you had 10 diseases that are all arising more or less in parallel. Either they have 10 different causes that all happened at the same time, or there's one thing that is underlying everything. And that's my theory, which I discuss in Missing Microbes, is that there is one thing underlying it, and that is a change in our ancient microbiome, our ancient ecosystem that we've had since time immemorial, as an unintended consequence of all the medical advances that we have, including especially antibiotics.
And let's break down some of the numbers. You talked about how much more obesity there is just in the past decade, not only in the U.S., but you noticed it in places like Chichen Itza.
Obesity is rising all over the world, especially in developed countries like the United States and Europe, but it's beginning to be present in China. It's beginning to be present in India, even in Africa. Obesity may be a bigger problem than malnutrition is. In the last decades, this has just come up worldwide. So something very important must be going on that is shared. Now, there's a lot of interest, of course, in food and calories and taking in too many calories. But diet alone hasn't been sufficient for us to understand what's going on in obesity. Diet is important, but it's not enough. And again, my hypothesis is that changes in our microbiome, these cells that are doing work for us, are important. And I want to introduce another concept, and that is we can think about the organisms in us at different stages of life. And to me, the most important organisms are the ones that are present early in life when we're really young kids, or our kids are really young, or our grandkids. We know now that these organisms are part of the development of our systems, of our processes in the body, metabolism, immunity, maybe even cognition. So if you perturb them early in life, you may change the course of development toward an individual who is pretty much destined to gain a lot of weight, for example.
How is this happening? One, you mentioned, is the antibiotics introduced at a very young age because it kills a lot of these microbes or it disturbs the balance. But the other you talk about is this increasing use of cesareans. How can that be related?
So we humans are mammals, and one of the characteristics of mammals is that they produce live birth, and the baby goes through a birth canal. So we don't lay eggs like birds do. And in the course of passing from the womb through the birth canal, a baby is picking up all these microbes from their mom. Part of the heredity of being a mammal is that you pick up your mom's microbes on your way out. And then you continue to pick up mom's microbes through contact with skin and mouth. But when a baby is born by cesarean section, they're missing this early contact. They're missing their introduction with the organisms that in other kids become the foundation for all the microbes in their body.
The connection with things like diabetes, celiac disease, how are these all related?
Well, there have been epidemiologic studies in which groups of moms and babies have been studied, large groups of hundreds or thousands of people, showing that babies born by C-section were more likely to have some of the markers of obesity or celiac disease or juvenile diabetes. So it's not that this is a theoretical risk. There's already evidence suggesting that there may be a cost to C-section that nobody was appreciating. Not a cost a day after birth or a week after birth, but a cost that's manifesting 10 years after birth, 20 years after birth. And there are precedents for this. And I want to come back to one of the earlier points, because for me, one day a light bulb went off, and that was, I knew for a long time that farmers feed antibiotics to their farm animals so that they'll gain weight. This is very widely done. It's where most of the antibiotics in the United States are going, on the farm, not to people. They're going to farm animals for the express purpose of promoting growth. And the reason they do this and they use so much antibiotics is because it works. They found that if they give antibiotics to young animals, they'll gain weight faster. Their feed efficiency improves. That's the ability to change food calories into body mass. And one day for me, about 10 years ago, a light bulb went off, and I thought, well, farmers are doing that, feeding antibiotics to increase the growth of their livestock. What are we doing to our children? Is it possible that the antibiotics we're giving our young kids for their throat infections, their ear infections, is having an unintended consequence, and that is that it's fattening them up. And that's what we've been working on for the last 10 years, and I talk about some of this work in Missing Microbes.
In terms of the unintended consequences, there are also others. We've got antibiotics in our water, in our soil, in our food. We're also seeing resistant bacteria.
Anytime antibiotics are used, it selects for resistance. Antibiotics will kill the susceptible bacteria, and the ones that are resistant will remain, and they'll take over the spot where the susceptible ones were. This is what Charles Darwin called natural selection. He didn't even recognize this with microbes, but ultimately Darwin was right. If you don't believe in Darwin's concepts of evolution, all you have to do is study bacteria and the development of antibiotic resistance, and you see it very clearly.
What's the consequence of some of these resistant bacteria?
Consequences, unfortunately, are very serious. Before we had antibiotics, people would die from pneumonia. They would die from meningitis. They might die of blood poisoning from a splinter or something like that. There were many fatal infections. Now, with antibiotics, most of those infections are treatable. Most of them are curable. Also, in order to do cancer chemotherapy, to do transplantation, to do major surgery, we need an umbrella of antibiotics around so that if somebody gets sick, we can treat them. I'm a doctor. If we have somebody who's getting chemotherapy, infection is a very major problem, so we can treat them with antibiotics. It would be a shame to suppress somebody's tumor, but then they die of an infection. So in order to have modern medicine, we need antibiotics. And if the antibiotics stop working because our bacteria have become resistant to them, then we could move back to an era when we can't do these surgeries. It's not just the cases of pneumonia, but it's the very ability to do things that we now take for granted, surgery, hip replacements. You know, if you didn't have antibiotics, you couldn't really do hip replacements because infections occur and they could be lethal.
And given that the antibiotics are so prevalent now in food, in water, in the soil, and is there any avoiding it?
Well, that's a very good question. There have been surveys that showed that because of the tremendous use of antibiotics on the farm, when you go to the supermarket, your meat may be contaminated by antibiotics. According to the regulations, it's not supposed to happen. But surveys have shown that it does happen. Not in every case, but in some cases. And we haven't surveyed this enough, but we know it can be present in meat. We know it can be present in milk. And some cities, their drinking water intake is just downstream of the effluent from one of these large industrial farms. So they're getting antibiotics in their water. What we can say is that there are probably millions of exposures every day in the United States of people to low levels of antibiotics, trace levels of antibiotics. What's the consequence? We don't know. Maybe there is no consequence. Maybe it's completely safe. Or maybe when you talk about it millions of times, that's what's contributing to so many of these rising diseases.
I think I saw in your book, Missing Microbes, that they had found resistant bacteria in about half the samples of meat that they tested.
It depends on the survey, but whether it's 20% or 80%, when you eat meat that you get at the supermarket, there's a reasonable chance that there is some trace level of antibiotic. And also the milk that our children drink. Kids who are drinking milk every day, there's a risk that they're getting antibiotics. Some parents say, my child has never had an antibiotic, but probably that's not true.
I noticed you were writing about neurons in our guts, and you said there's something like 100 million neurons. And these neurons signal to the brain all kinds of things related to hunger, mood, cognitive development. But they're signaling based on interaction with microbes. How is this affected by the antibiotic use?
I'll give you the bottom line first. We don't know. It's a wide open question. But as you say, there's an increasing body of evidence that the nature of the microbes in our gut, the composition of them, the genes that they carry, affect the signals, the neural signals going from our gut via a number of nerves right up to the brain. I mean, sometimes people say, I feel hungry in my gut. Somehow your brain has learned that. That's a very simple example. But there are increasing connections between the gut and the development of the brain in terms of thinking, of cognition. There's some work suggesting there's a relationship with mood. You know, the nervous system is a big chemical factory, and some of the chemicals that are coming in from below could definitely influence what's going on.
Let me just remind listeners that we're speaking with Martin Blaser, and he is the author of Missing Microbes, How the Overuse of Antibiotics is Fueling Our Modern Plagues. Now, let's go back to the plagues. We've talked a lot about obesity. We talked a little bit about diabetes. We mentioned celiac disease. But there were several others that you had talked about in the book. One is the esophageal reflux, which causes heartburn. One is asthma. One is eczema. How many of these so-called modern plagues do you think are related to the overuse of antibiotics?
You mentioned esophageal reflux, asthma, and eczema. And these have been related to an organism that lives in the stomach called Helicobacter pylori. It's an organism I've been studying for about 30 years. And Helicobacter was discovered in the 1980s to be a major cause of stomach ulcers. In fact, the people who discovered it won the Nobel Prize. And later, we and others discovered that this bacteria had a major role in stomach cancer. So everything was indicating that this was a very bad organism. But the more we studied it, the more we realized that this organism is quite ancient, that people have had it in their stomach since time immemorial. But as a result of modern life, this bacterium is disappearing. And this is one of the places that I got the idea about for missing microbes, that some of our ancient organisms that are longtime residents, our friends, are disappearing. Well, Helicobacter is not just a friend because it can cause ulcers and it can cause cancer. But there now is a wide body of research suggesting that Helicobacter also protects the esophagus, protecting against high acid and reflux, and that people who don't have Helicobacter are at much higher risk for getting reflux esophagitis, and occasionally they can get a condition called Barrett's esophagus, and occasionally they can get esophageal cancer as well. So as Helicobacter is disappearing, gastric cancer is disappearing, but esophageal cancer is rising, and asthma is rising, and eczema is rising, and we have found evidence linking the lack of Helicobacter to these diseases, as if Helicobacter pylori was protective against getting these diseases, and now we've lost it.
In essence, if we were going to then turn to solutions, would you say that besides the reduction in use of the antibiotics, do you think that the germophobia is a little bit too extreme? We thought that we had to be more sanitary in order to protect life. Now, are we too sanitary?
I think you hit the nail on the head with the term you use, germophobia. Because there are some very bad germs, like the germ that causes tuberculosis or the virus that causes HIV, et cetera, because there are very bad germs, we have focused on those, forgetting for the moment that the world is full of germs. We live in a world of bacteria. Most of them are neutral to us, and many of them are good for us. They're beneficial to us, like many of the organisms in our own body. And so, to me, the fear is that by using these antibacterial substances, we use these soaps, they're in certain foods, etc., that we're causing collateral damage to our good guys, the good bacteria. And ultimately, when we have people washing their hands tens of millions of times a day across the United States with these antibacterial soaps, I don't know whether we're doing more good or more harm. It just hasn't been determined. But on a positive note, I think positive, the state of Minnesota banned the use of antibacterial soaps. They said there's no reason to use it. It's no better than soap and water. And I applaud that because I'm concerned that those antibiotic soaps are wounding our microbiome, our ancient composition. It's not like it's wounding us, but we're getting a lot of benefit from it. It's not clear that we're getting any benefit from it. And so there's only a biological cost.
In terms of other potential policies, solutions, it sounds like you also think this overuse of antibiotic on the farms is a big problem.
Yes, it is a big problem because it's spilling over into humans, the antibiotic residues in food. And also it's a problem because of resistant organisms. When antibiotics are used on the farm, it selects for bacteria that are resistant to their action. And sometimes these bacteria come over to humans. There have been many examples with Salmonella and Campylobacter, two important disease-causing organisms. The use on the farm has made some of these strains antibiotic resistant, and now when people are getting the infections from eating the foods of animal origin, they're getting infected with antibiotic resistant organisms. So this actually has been well known for a number of years, and the Food and Drug Administration is taking some early steps to ban the use of antibiotics on the farm. I would call it baby steps. And our free and aroused citizenry has to push the policymakers to actually do the right thing, to get these antibiotics out of the farm. In Europe, they banned it about 10 years ago.
Martin Blaser, thank you so much for being with us here on the Scholar Circle.
It's really my pleasure to talk to you.
The book, again, is called Missing Microbes, How the Overuse of Antibiotics is Fueling Our Modern Plagues. When we come back, what exactly is brewing in the South China Sea? Stay tuned. You are listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Is China militarizing the South China Sea? That's one of a few concerns for many in the region about China's territorial claims and its development of a region that also has claims by the Philippines, Vietnam, Malaysia, and Brunei. What exactly is brewing in the South China Sea? And what is the significance of China's activities there for the rest of the region and for the world? Four experts join us now. Dr. Pradeep Taneja lectures in the School of Social and Political Sciences at the University of Melbourne and is the author of The European Union and China, Interests and Dilemmas. Dr. Stephen Noakes is also with us. He's a lecturer in politics and international relations and Asian studies at the University of Auckland. He's the author of Support for Civil Society in China. Daniel Lynch is also with us. He's a professor of international relations at the University of Southern California and the author of After the Propaganda State, Media, Politics, and Thought in Reform China, Rising China, and Asian Democratization. Leszek Buzinski is with us. He's a professor at Australian National University and the author of Asia-Pacific Security, Values, and Identity. Welcome to the Scholar Circle. Great to have all four of you here with us. I like to start to understand these political developments with a historic context. Leszek Buzinski, could you tell us what historically we need to understand to make sense of this dispute?
A very complex issue, but basically what we have is a Chinese claim based on what many consider to be rather dubious grounds and which clashes with Malaysian claims. And Vietnamese have a claim which is similar to the Chinese and has similar weaknesses, which they are unwilling to admit. But the Malaysians and the Filipinos have moved much more closely to uncross the law of the sea, and that creates a very complex situation here, where China is increasingly basing its claim upon dubious historical grounds, and the others have moved towards UNCLOS as the justification for their claims, in particular the exclusive economic zone and continental shelf. And so one aspect of the whole dispute is China's historical claim versus the legal claims of the ASEAN claimants. How that works out in the future is a matter for discussion.
Dan Lynch, why don't we bring you in? I know you've been looking at this issue quite a bit, too. First of all, would you agree with the characterization? And I understand this is a 20-year-plus issue. So bring us up to speed as to how this is developed.
Well, as early as 1992, the Chinese National People's Congress passed a law codifying China's claims to the South China Sea. That was important from a legal point of view because it was going to allow the PRC state mechanisms to lease plots of water, if you will, sections of the water for possible oil and natural gas exploration. There were a few incidents like Mischief Reef incident when the PLA quietly occupied this tiny reef off the coast of the Philippines. the winter of 94, 95. There were a few incidents like that. But it's only since the global financial crisis in end of 2008, early 2009, since then, the Chinese state has become much more assertive. Some people use the term aggressive in other terms, and it's very obvious in asserting their claims and following through and making it look like they actually claim the entire South China Sea, although they haven't said that formally yet. There are two real theories as to why 2009 became that kind of turning point. The most common theory is that PRC elites who make foreign policy and security policy decisions judged from the crisis that the United States was now on the verge of declining precipitously, and certain other Western countries and Japan, and now China was finally seeing its day in the sun. That proved to be highly premature, as China's economy is in a shambles now, but that's probably the reason. Either that, and the other possibility is simply that they know that their economic rise is probably only has 5-10 more years at most because of the demographic implosion problem. So maybe they want to strike while the iron's hot before the window of opportunity closes.
Pradeep Taneja, what would you add?
If you go back to the Chinese claim, the Chinese Communist Party has been making these claims that this is not only historical but also legal, but at the same time they're not willing to have these claims or their claims tested in a court of law, which is really the problem. I mean, the Philippines has called the bluff and said, okay, if you say it is legal, then let's have the claims tested in the court of law. The Chinese have been very reluctant, and they keep going back to their historical claims. But it is also true, when we're talking about the historical context, that it was the Kuomintang government before the Communist Party took power in 1949, which first released the 11-dash line, which has now become the 9-dash line claim. But given that the Chinese are saying that this is both historical and legal, why don't they actually, you know, be prepared to say, okay, let's go to a court of law and let's have this claim tested?
So what international law does govern this? Stephen Noakes?
The closest thing that we have at the moment to a set of institutional oversights is referred to as UNCLOS. It's the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea, which is supposed to provide with countries, a party to this dispute, a mechanism to submit claims that would, in effect, allow them to stake out territory based on the extension of their continental shelf total of 200 nautical miles from their shores. This is, I think, one of the key factors in sort of turning public attention back to the dispute in the spring of 2009. A couple of submissions have been made under this scheme so far, one by the Vietnamese over a portion of the water, including that around the Paracel Islands, and another jointly made by Vietnam and Malaysia for a joint claim over what they simply called a defined area in the middle of the South China Sea that includes a chunk of the water on the Spratlys as well. Brunei, which is also a potential claimant, has not submitted a claim under this mechanism, but has actually gone as far as to provide some preliminary information to the UN, notifying the UN of its intent to submit a claim based on this extension of the continental shelf type of argument.
If I could just add something here, because I would go a little further and say that when we speak law, we refer to UNCLOS, UN Convention of the Law of the Sea, that's one thing. But also there is international law, the corpus of international law, which was built up in the times preceding the negotiation of UNCLOS. And there we can assess, using international law, we can assess the Chinese claims, because the Chinese always talk about history, indisputable sovereignty, ancient title and so forth. Whereas international law does not admit of historical claims. China's references to history clashes with the body of international law and the conventions and the rulings which govern historical title within certain limited areas. And here we have a real conundrum, because the Chinese have said, and many Chinese scholars have said, that our historical claim to the area, say the Chinese, should be recognized because the claim was made prior to international law, and on top of that, you have some with whom I have contact who say that international law was really formulated by Western countries and therefore not applicable to our claim in the South China Sea, and therefore the whole thing should be renegotiated. International law should be renegotiated so it should accept historical claims such as the Chinese claim of the South China Sea. And if the Chinese become much more confident about their claim in this respect, it will be a direct challenge to what we know as international law.
Pradeep Taneja?
The legal issues are very complex, and as to which law applies, clearly there is one process that the Philippines has taken China to, and that's one, you know, legal avenue. But China first has to be willing to actually agree to have these claims tested in a court of law. And then perhaps, you know, all the claimant states can come to some sort of agreement as to what sort of legal process we want to have. So on the one hand, China claims that, yes, we have historical claims, but also legal claims. But at the same time, we don't want to go to a court of law.
Dan Lynch.
One of the interesting things about the Chinese claim is not only does it predate international law in the minds of people in the Chinese Communist Party, but also just fundamentally takes precedent over anything else that might follow. I mean, if you ask some super patriots in China to debate this issue and ask them, well, what's the basis of China's claim to the South China Sea? The answer is, it just belongs to China. I mean, that's a fundamental precondition. It's China. That's why we claim it, because it's China. Talk about how the ancestors of today's Filipinos must have sailed across those waters, or the ancestors of today's Vietnamese and so on, for millennia even, long before anyone who we would think of today as being Chinese went down there, maybe occasionally. And so if you try to make a logical argument like that, or an international legal argument, it just doesn't matter. On the other hand, though, it's really sensible and clever strategy of the Philippines, especially, to take the matter to international law, because China would probably lose the case. And if so, that'll have an effect on international public opinion. And the Philippines will at least score a moral victory, and that'll be important.
We've talked about some of the claimants, but it affects far more geopolitically than just those few claimants, as I understand it. How would you describe the geopolitics, Stephen Noakes?
There are a number of things at play here. The first, and I think probably most importantly from a broader geopolitical standpoint, is the issue of oil and gas reserves in the seabed. And this is where I think much of the United States' interest comes into play. In 1968, the Chinese ministry responsible for overseeing these sorts of surveys alleged that there were at that time 18 billion tons of oil and gas reserves in the seabed around the Spratlys. So to put that in a bit of context, Kuwait, one of the richest, if not the single richest, Gulf state, is thought to have around 13 billion tons in totals. We're not talking about very little oil under there. We're talking about theoretically enough to power China's economic rise for decades and decades to come. This is also about not simply the oil itself, but the means by which oil gets around the globe. This is about access to shipping lanes to some extent. During the 1980s, there were, on average, about 275 ships passing through the Spratlys region each and every day, and it's now thought to be somewhere in the neighborhood of half the world's total tonnage of supertanker traffic goes through the South China Sea every single year. This is the prime means by which oil from the Middle East makes it to the Chinese seaboard, to Japan, and so on. This is a major, major, major pipeline for oil. It's going to be geopolitically important for these same reasons for China as the One Belt, One Road type initiatives start to take off. The Strait of Malacca is really the gateway to ultimately the Gulf of Aden and the source of all of that oil. Last but not least, I'd say this is partly, anyways, about access to fishing territory, which is quite lucrative as well. In 1988, the South China Sea accounted for roughly 8 or 9% of the total world's catch. So this is a geopolitical issue that has a number of sides to it and consequently draws in a huge number of players.
So you would see this as really important, largely for economic reasons. What about military? I understand there's a military buildup going on as well.
There is. China, for example, is constructing an airstrip and so on, Fiery Cross Reef now. I think to those who would be adversaries, Filipinos, Vietnamese, and so on, certainly that is emblematic of China's growing dominance in the region, and those kinds of symbolic factors can't be discounted, but there are meaningful material issues at play here as well.
Lizak Bozinski?
When you speak of geopolitics, we're looking at the military security dimension. And in particular, I would emphasize the point that Chinese claims to the area present a real challenge to the American position in the Western Pacific. Now, look at it this way, that China's Navy is developing China wants carriers, it wants to project power abroad for various reasons related to the Taiwan conflict, related to protection of its sea lanes and so forth. Now, if you look at China's maritime geography, it can't do that in the north because it's the Korean Peninsula, Thailand and so forth, because that area is too close to Japan, and Japan's naval power is also developing. It can't do it in the center because that is Taiwan. That's where Taiwan-dominated area, and Taiwan is closely the state. The only place where it can have an outlet to the Pacific or to the Indian Ocean, an outlet for it, more carriers will come online in the future, is through the South China Sea, the Malacca Straits, and so forth. So this becomes a very important area for the Chinese Navy. And we certainly think that the Chinese Navy is one of the factors behind China's recent assertive move in the South China Sea, that the Navy has an input, as far as we can understand the situation there. Now, this means that as China really needs to dominate that area, that's what the Navy needs, secure access, that requires control over the area, and achieves that secure access, it affects the American position, because firstly, Japan would be affected. We had, in terms of the sea lane traffic and so forth, the Japanese fear that China could gain a stranglehold over sea lane traffic to Japan. Of course, it could be rerouted elsewhere, but at considerable cost to the Japanese economy. And that brings Japan and the United States back together. And the United States cannot simply surrender the issue without affecting relations with Japan and Korea. And if the Americans, and some people have said that this issue doesn't concern the United States for the sake of better relations with China, the United States should simply concede the South China Sea to China. But if some American administration that it would affect alliance relationships with Japan, Korea, and also within ASEAN, the ASEAN countries would gravitate towards China and China would emerge as the dominant power in that area. And the United States would be confined to an offshore position in the Western Pacific. Slowly but surely, the United States' position in that area would disintegrate.
Do you agree, Dan Lynch?
Let's remember that at the northern terminus of the South China Sea is Hainan province of China, an island. And that's home to an extremely important naval base for the People's Liberation Army Navy at Sanya. And that is thought to be where the PLA Navy's nuclear-armed, nuclear-powered submarines are lodged, caves under the water. And I've heard, I don't know whether it's true, these are, you know, rumors you hear at cocktail parties and so on, that the PLA needs South China Sea to more or less be a Chinese lake because its nuclear-armed submarines, which it needs for the third leg of its nuclear deterrent tripod, can't get out of the South China Sea without being detected by the Singaporean Navy, the U.S. Navy, because the submarines are too loud. So it needs a huge space like the South China Sea to maintain that third leg of the tripod. At least that's what I've heard. I don't know. It's not confirmed, but plausible.
Pradeep Taneja.
Yes, I agree with Stephen that energy is a big issue and the sea lanes, China being one of the biggest trading nations, in fact, the biggest trading nations, there are commercial and energy interests. But I think geopolitics and China's self-perception as the rising power is, I think, what's driving this whole thing. Because if China is to project its power, which would be the best place? Clearly, in the maritime domain, in China's own neighborhood, this would be the best area for China to project power. And South China Sea, somebody's called it, you know, China's Caribbean, for example. I mean, this is where China is trying to demonstrate to the United States and to the rest of the world that it is the greatest power in this part of the world, whether you like it or not, and our power is growing, and therefore we will assert our power. And South China Sea, and particularly the Spratlyan Parasols, have become the stage for China to project its power. But at the same time, I think we have to remember that there are questions of China's own, you know, multiple identities. On the one hand, China is projecting itself as this rising great power, but at the same time, China has been telling the rest of the world that we will never seek hegemony. The United States is a hegemonic power. We will never be like the United States. We will never seek hegemony. And as far as China's neighbors are concerned in Southeast Asia, China is telling them that our rise, our economic and military rise, is good for you. You have nothing to worry about it. So I think what we are seeing coming out of China is very contradictory, you know, images of how China would like the rest of the world to see itself. I mean, clearly there is a competition with the United States I've just come back from Beijing and talking to international relations scholars in Beijing. It is very obvious that there is this perception. I mean, people are convinced in China that China is now the rising power and the United States needs to make way for China. And what better place than the South China Sea for China to show to the United States and to the rest of the world that China is now the hegemonic power in this part of the world. So I think we have to consider not only the geopolitical moves, we have to consider domestic factors in China, what's going on in China in terms of how China defines itself. So on the one hand, China defines itself as a very different power to the United States or other powers of the past, but at the same time, China wants to show that it is a strong and powerful country. So I think the contradictory messages that are coming out of China are also reflected in the policies. For example, we've seen, China abandon Deng Xiaoping's, Cao Guang Yanghui's advice and become much more assertive. But then at the same time, over the last couple of weeks, we have seen China saying that, no, we are stopping construction, in this Spratlys. For now, we have done enough. We don't need to do any more. This should suffice for now. So these are conflicting messages. And I think within China, there are debates going on among Chinese scholars as to, how to proceed in this area.
Stephen Noakes.
I would simply add that I think it's absolutely true that there are domestic factors in China that need to be considered in thinking about how Chinese power is projected around the world in whatever form. I think that a lot of this is very difficult for us as outsiders to come to know in a replicable and very credible way sometimes. It's not something we're always privy to. But certainly the internal political dynamics are something that do have to be considered here. And in particular, I think it's going to be very important to remember that the Chinese Communist Party, perhaps despite outward appearances, is like all political parties everywhere in the sense that it has factions, it has wings. It does not think as one, at least not all of the time. And so if there were somebody out there with access sufficient to make a credible case, there are volumes and volumes that could be written on this.
What about the U.S. now? Dan Lynch, you were quoted in a documentary saying that the U.S. is trying to shape China's rise. What's going on there?
When was the documentary exactly?
Oh, gosh. I think this was a few years ago, but I dredged it up.
8 years ago? Yeah, well, I think it's long been United States policy. I mean, it's open record to welcome China into the international community. And that concretely meant paving the way for China to enter the World Trade Organization and other such institutions. But also in the hope that the more radical foreign policy orientations and domestic policies of decades past would fade away over time. The term in Chinese for this is peaceful evolution. That's not a positive term in China, but it's basically what it was all about. So how does that relate to this, you're asking? I guess, I mean, a lot of people are now saying that at least for those people who are really enthusiastic about constructive engagement leading to change in China and really believing that was going to be a major development have been shown to be wrong, and because it's not happening. If anything, it looks like China, I mean, and other people though were saying all along, China is far too big, far too complex, and far older than age matters in China, older than the United States, and it will not be changed by the United States. And so that's one of the debates going on right now in the United States. But there's no solution as to what to do because you really have no choice but to engage China. I mean, it's a net positive in most ways, I'd say. And what are you going to do? The only alternative is confrontation that could prove very dangerous. But definitely it's shaping the debate here.
Stephen Noakes.
I think that Dan is absolutely right. I think it's certainly true that China is extremely unlikely to be convinced of a course of action that it doesn't necessarily already favor for its own reasons. And so I think what that probably means is that the United States can do a certain amount of agenda setting by, say, providing China with a certain range of conceivable options or something like that. But it is simply not the case that those who would make the sorts of policies that manifest themselves in the South China Sea are particularly receptive to American thinking on the issue anyways. And even if they were, there's no concrete mechanism by which they could be convinced. So there really is no alternative to this process of socializing China, if you like. It's the opposite of the old-time Cold War era strategy of isolation. The thinking was that if Cuba was left to flounder on its own, eventually it would crumble and see the light. Well, that turned out not to be the case. So really, there's nothing left to do but open the doors and do your best to see a certain amount of values transference from the United States and from other key players in the international community. The risky side of this is the other side of the coin. What if China's not simply a norm taker, but a norm maker? In what ways we expect an ascendant China to actually recreate some of the rules of the game? And what can we expect? Is that something we are prepared to grapple with?
Simultaneously, you know, I saw in the news that there are some military exercises going on with the U.S. being involved and Japan being involved. I think this is particularly in the Philippines. Is this significant with regards to the dispute?
Sure. A lot of these have gone on for years in a regular way, but there are not only exercises going on, but Japan and the Philippines are working really closely together. As I understand it, the Japanese Coast Guard, which is almost like a Navy now after a lot of increases in spending and so on in the 2000s, working really closely with the Philippines Coast Guard, supplying ships and other sorts of vessels. And I believe Japan's doing that with Vietnam, too. So there are a lot of things like that going on, not necessarily the United States directly doing it, but U.S. allies. And even Japan's even working with India to help turn India even more of an export powerhouse, all with thinking in mind that we need to balance against China's rise. So this is engagement, but it's engagement with kind of a backdoor or an insurance hedging. It's not relying entirely on engagement, hoping China is socialized into the kind of state that others might like to see, but also, just in case it doesn't work out, arming and training some of China's adversaries in the South China Sea.
Lazak Buzinski, what would you add?
Those military exercises that you refer to are indicative of greater regional concern in relation to China's assertive moves in the area. What China has been doing in the South China Sea is linked with what China's been doing in relation to the Japan and Sengoku Daiyu situation. That draws Japan in. So you have, with this steady assertiveness that we've witnessed on the part of China in that area, we've also seen a great propensity amongst the ASEAN countries to seek out greater support against China. Now, I find it very interesting that both Indonesia and Malaysia are seeking out, looking for a closer security relationship with the United States. They don't want to speak about it publicly because they talk in terms of non-alignment and neutrality and so forth, and they don't want to be considered allies of the U.S., but they are very worried and they're very concerned, and they have initiated steps towards greater security cooperation with the United States. And this means that China could be faced with a situation where the United States would be able to orchestrate security coalitions in the South China Sea in relation to China, and that makes the Chinese draw back. Earlier we had this discussion about U.S.-China relations and, of course, engagement and so forth, dialogue, but within the context of engagement and dialogue, I see these security relationships, security coalitions building up, which include Australia as well, not New Zealand, and this will make the Chinese, I think, draw back. So it's a process of moving forward for the Chinese and then drawing back, moving forward and then drawing back. As far as we understand traditional Chinese strategy, Chinese strategic culture, they have no intention of precipitating a clash, a conflict. They don't work that way. They move slowly and incrementally. And where the United States and its allies draw certain red lines, then they will draw back and wait for the future. And the future will be more propitious for a similar move. If the United States and its allies can hold firm, Japan will hold firm. There are some questions about a future United States administration. Then China will simply bide its time. And the situation may change in China, and China indeed may release the pressure in that area.
Pradeep Taneja.
If you talk about the United States' interest here, lately we've seen a spate of studies coming out of the United States saying that constructive engagement with China hasn't quite worked. Now, it's worked in the sense that it's maintained a degree of stability, but China continues to rise. China continues to challenge the United States' position particularly in this part of the world. So for the U.S., I think the South China Sea has become a test case. If the U.S. doesn't succeed in its strategy in the South China Sea, then certainly there's no stopping China in other parts of the world. So in terms of projection of Chinese power, it is going to continue to grow. U.S. approach in the South China Sea has been that, yes, we are not a claimant state, but at the same time, we would like this dispute to be settled in a peaceful manner. U.S. has been championing a code of conduct in the South China Sea. We saw in 2002 a declaration on the code of conduct. 13 years later, we still don't have a code of conduct. So U.S. position is that we really want to, as Stephen said, socialize China into the norms that have been created over the past six, seven decades. But at the same time, China is dragging its feet when it comes to the code of conduct. So while China talks about, you know, legal and historical claims, when it comes to actually setting legal precedents or creating a framework for a, you know, peaceful resolution of this problem, China seems to be dragging its feet. So for the U.S., I think the South China Sea has become a test case in terms of how it deals with China and particularly the rise of China.
So how do we see this resolving? Lezak Bozinski, do you see a path to resolution here?
Everyone expects or at least discusses resolution. Very unlikely. This issue has been going on for decades, well before the 1988 incident. We should look at the January 74 case when the Chinese expelled the South Vietnamese from the Western parasols. No, it'll simply continue. The Chinese have much at stake here. The Chinese cannot back down. No Chinese leadership can back down over this issue. The Chinese party has whipped up nationalism over this. Many Chinese scholars in Beijing and elsewhere are thoroughly convinced that it had always been, always has been Chinese territory. They didn't say that in the past. This is a recent development, this strong belief that it is Chinese territory. Going to law to negotiate or to negotiate with ASEAN or the ASEAN claimants over this issue is simply not on for the Chinese. They'll simply wait it out and hope that sometime in the future the time will be more propitious for them to assert their claims once more. No, no, no. Some issues in international affairs are not susceptible to immediate resolution. They just carry on. And sometimes we have to live with them. The Korean Peninsula is another issue. They just carry on.
Dan Lynch?
I think that's absolutely right. But there's also an elephant in the living room here, and that is that the Chinese economic development model strikes me as already right now bankrupt. But we don't have time to go into detail to all the indicators, the signs, but basically, they've been relying on excessive investment relative to consumption and even net exports to grow GDP. And to the point, though, where they've run out of viable investment projects. And so people, especially state-owned enterprises, have been taking out bank loans, investing in projects that aren't generating revenues sufficient to pay back the loans. So they take out new loans to service the old loans. So that now the debt-to-GDP ratio has reached 282% as of 2 weeks ago. And there's just a lot of other indicators. And this is, by the way, almost universally recognized among Chinese economists. So I think would be, if they were in charge, they'd be much less likely to pursue such a forward policy in the South China. So this is likely, I think, to unfold over the next 5-6 years, become obvious to everyone. What we don't know, though, is what that would mean for foreign policy. I mean, if the Chinese leadership is united and rational, then you'd want to pull back a little bit. And instead of investing $49 billion in Pakistan as part of One Belt, One Road, and the tens of billions of other dollars they plan to invest in other parts of the world, it's a reflection of that investment-driven economic growth. They need to take those resources and thoroughly clean up the Chinese environment, because now the death rates are rising again, people over 50. And kids who are growing up in that environment are going to be supremely unhealthy and probably die young. So, and there are water shortages. Those aren't sexy investments and eye-catching investments necessarily, but that is where the most good could be done instead of this kind of foreign policy adventurism. So we don't know whether those should be the wisest course or if, because they feel embattled now that the rise, people will stop using that term rise of China. They'll probably start using rise of India instead. How will the PLA, which has an enormous influence over security policy, react possibly in a defensive and more aggressive? We don't know how that'll turn out.
Pradeep Taneja.
I agree with Lesak that this is something which is not going to be resolved anytime soon. This is a problem that's going to continue. But there is another issue, I think, which is related to the end game, and that is China's grand strategy. And there seems to be a grand strategy emerging in China. And Xi Jinping's One Belt, One Road initiative seems to be part of the grand strategy. And in fact, the recent decision, an announcement by the Chinese government that we've kind of done enough in terms of land reclamation in the South China Sea, may be linked to that grand strategy, because China cannot expect to get the cooperation of all of its, you know, Asian neighbors, and particularly Southeast Asian neighbors, and at the same time keep very aggressively asserting its territorial claims. And if the One Belt, One Road, and particularly the maritime, you know, Silk Road, if that is the bigger game in China, then I think we could see China slowing down its aggressive position in the South China Sea in the interest of a bigger or grander strategy. But that's one hope, that China may, in fact, start to ease up a little bit in the South China Sea.
Stephen Oakes?
I think it's probably true that this can't be immediately resolved and that it won't be. I think likely what you'll see is periodic flare-ups and the issue recede into abeyance, only to be resurrected every couple of years or something like that. I suppose in a theoretical kind of sense, I'm simply too much of a realist to have a lot of faith in institutions as always being effective mechanisms for dispute resolution. Normally, they depend on a substantial buy-in from players, as we've already heard, who might not necessarily feel like making those buy-ins. And for that reason, I think that you won't see this disappear from the headlines for the foreseeable future.
Taiwan election for the president in January. Probably the DPP will win. They might even win the legislature in March. That could usher in a sea change, and it could bring out hawks in Chinese foreign policy circles again. So that there's a wild card.
And just for listeners who don't know, that is because?
That's because the DPP, the opposition, which looks likely to definitely win the presidency, possibly take the legislature for the first time in history, would control both the major branches of government. And it's officially in favor of realizing de jure independence from China and does not accept the one China principle. So it's inherently provocative to the PRC.
Gentlemen, thank you so much for this. Pradeep Taneja, Leszek Baczynski, Dan Lynch, Stephen Noakes, thank you so much for being with us here on the Scholar Circle.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Pradeep Taneja lectures in the School of Social and Political Sciences at the University of Melbourne and is the author of The European Union and China, Interests and Dilemmas. Dr. Stephen Noakes is a lecturer in politics and international relations and Asian studies at the University of Auckland. He's the author of Support for Civil Society in China. Daniel Lynch is a professor of international relations at the University of Southern California and the author of After the Propaganda State, Media, Politics, and Thought in Reform China, Rising China, and Asian Democratization. Leszek Baczynski is a professor at Australian National University and the author of Asia-Pacific Security, Values, and Identity. That's it for today's Scholar Circle. Thank you to our guests and to our producers, Melissa Chipper and Ankine Agassian, for making this show possible. Also to Sud Dongre, our webmaster, and most of all to you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can go back to kpfk.org and click on the archives, or to our own archives at armudian.com and scholarcircle.org. You can also subscribe to our podcast through Stitcher or iTunes and follow us on Twitter at @armudian.